KALW.
Getting outside is so important to health, and it would be important to health anytime.
Public health officials consider the risks and benefits when making policies about going outdoors right now.
When we reduce how far people can travel, who still has access to open space and parks?
We'll hear how the question of equity plays into getting outside. Then we'll go to the beach to solve a mystery on the shore.
We're looking at a giant graveyard of Valella. Kind of looks almost like plastic pollution.
And a Bay Area poet writes about her deep connection to animals and nature.
There's a certain patience in trying to understand animals that I really embrace as a part of the living world.
Plus, we continue our New Arrivals series featuring Bay Area authors. That's coming up. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. The weather's getting warmer, and we're all accepting that sheltering in place may be the new reality for a long while. And so KALW science reporter Marissa Ortega-Welch reached out to Melissa Jones. She works for the Bay Area Regional Health Inequities Initiatives. It's a coalition of local public health departments. She helps all the county's public health officers decide on what the best practices are for policy decisions, including policies for getting outdoors. Marissa talked to Melissa over video chat about what the public health officers are considering when they make policies for what we can and can't do outside right now.
Your organization is focused on health inequities. It's in the name, right? Why is an organization that thinks about health inequities thinking about policy considerations for getting outside?
Well, because getting outside is so important to health, and it would be important to health anytime. But certainly it's important to health in a time when there is less access to recreation than there is before. And so we're thinking a lot about doctor's offices and healthcare capacity right now, because this is such an important time for that. And every day, even when we're not in an epidemic, a huge proportion of our health is about the choices we have for things like recreation and access to healthy foods and all of those basics that keep us healthy.
So when you're getting together with all these public health officials and epidemiologists and park employees, what are the different factors that you're weighing in order to make policy recommendations around going outside?
So parks are such an important place in communities, and in particular in a time when many people are inside far more often than usual and at home for much longer periods of time. Being able to get out into open space becomes very important. It's the way people are able to get out and walk around and get the exercise you need that's so important for health in general, but really important for mental health right now too, and a stress reliever. And a lot of people talk about parks as the place that really is the mental wellness center for communities, right? It's where you get to be out by trees, out by grass, out breathing fresh air, ideally. Parks are also a place, right, where community connects and a place to be sometimes when it gets hot inside. If people can get out into parks and maintain social distancing in the space, that's a great opportunity for them and for all of us to be bringing down our stress levels, giving us some time to be outside, helping kids burn some energy, all of those things that are so important right now. The challenges, I think, with social distancing that, you know, when you're out in the park, we're used to being out in the park as we've always been out in the park. And so you're not necessarily thinking about how the world has changed, how you need to stand further apart, how you need to leave more room. So I think as people get going on their walk in the park or get deeply involved in a chat and conversation as they're watching their kids play, they can forget the social distancing rules and end up too close together. And this is what the public health departments and people who are engaged in running parks are considering as they think about how to keep this valuable space open to community at the same time that we're making sure everybody remains safe and inside the public health guidance.
So different counties seem to have come up with different rules. We saw Santa Cruz close down their beaches for a while. Why is that? Why are we seeing different counties make different decisions?
So, you know, this is a good conversation for each different health officer to see where their thinking has lied. But I think what they're all trying to do is weigh the risk for communities, what's likely to be too busy or not have the social distancing that we need right now. And the equity piece to think about in all of that is this question about where park access is. And so if we're not driving to parks, and if people are not on public transit and, or staying off public transit, what can they walk to in their neighborhood? And if they can't walk to the spaces in their neighborhood, what are the other alternatives for them to get outside safely? And we've seen some experiments in with this here in Oakland, where we've seen streets be shut down so there's more room for people to be outside moving and walking.
Right. And different counties seem to have different rules specifically about how far you can travel. San Mateo County was ticketing people who were traveling more than 5 miles from their residence to go to an outdoor area. How does your organization come down on that? If you live in the flats of Oakland, can you drive up into the hills to get some green space if you don't have it in your own neighborhood, for example?
I think the important equity consideration here is when we reduce how far people can travel, who still has access to open space and parks? And so that is actually quite different in different places, in different communities. And there are some really good resources out there to find out what park access looks like by neighborhood. That can be great tools in making those decisions.
So the weather is getting nicer, and we now know that we are going to be sheltering in place until at least the end of May. What are public health departments watching and considering right now? You know, you talked about there's all the benefits of getting outside, but then sometimes you get to chatting when you're on the trail and you kind of veer too close together. So I wonder if park officials are, you know, just kind of constantly thinking about that, weighing that.
They're thinking about things like making sure there's signage and other things so that people know what the guidance is in any particular place where you are.
You know, in general, your organization thinks about health inequities. What is this pandemic showing us about the health inequities that, you know, already existed in the Bay Area?
Yeah. So the pandemic has shown us a lot of difficult things about the racial disparity in health inequities. And so the data is still really being collected. There's more that we need to know, but we do know there's differential impacts for African Americans, for Pacific Islanders, as well as for the Latinx community. And so these are very important considerations in making sure messages get to people about how to stay safe and making sure the decisions that happen are promoting community level safety for people who have been most impacted and could be most at risk, and that resources that are available for things like testing and treatment are equitably distributed to those who need it most. Just want to thank everybody who's been working so hard on this balance of making sure we have the ability to get outside and maintain our social distancing, especially in communities that have had a difficult time with park access over time.
Melissa Jones is the executive director of the Bay Area Regional Health Inequities Initiative. She spoke to KELW science reporter Marissa Ortega-Welch. You can email her at science@kelw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. If you have been outside, to the ocean specifically, you'll notice little blue creatures have started washing up on shore again. They're about 2.5 inches across, they're blue, and kind of shaped like Pringles. They're called Velela velela, and sometimes they're beached by the millions. Why does this happen? In this story from our archives, KALW's Jessica Plachek has the answer.
There's a bunch of it down there. Look at that.
The Velela Graveyard.
I'm at a beach in Point Reyes with marine biologist Joe Mueller. And everywhere we look are little potato chips. Well, at least that's what they look like. But when you pick them up and smell them, you know they're biological and dead. They're dried up jellies.
And I bet you anything, if you turn this over, you would be able to maybe even see the moisture of life there.
This beach looks like dozens of other beaches in California right now, covered with dead jellies called Velella velella. Biologists say millions of them have washed up across the coast this year. Velella velella are also commonly called the by-the-wind sailor. In the ocean, they move along the surface using the clear triangular ridge or sail on their backs. They're at the wind's mercy. So when they beach, it's because of the wind and the climate conditions that create it. To understand their journey, we first need to understand how these little jellyfish work.
They're not true jellyfish. They're actually a colony of creatures we call hydroids.
Oh, okay, not jellyfish. But what exactly is a hydroid colony?
If we were to look at one, we'd see that it's a colony of a mix of sea anemone-like creatures.
You've seen sea anemones, right? They're those colorful tubular creatures with rings of tentacles at the top. Well, Velella colonies are like hundreds of sea anemones all floating together. Each one helps operate the blue Velella ship. It looks like a sail with bunches of tentacles hanging down.
So on the edge, all they do is sting. That's your job. What do you do in life? I'm a stinger. I just got stingers all over me, right? And then they have other individuals that are in there that are for feeding. And then there are the reproductive parts. And those parts on this little colony's job is to bud or asexually break off little kind of pieces of the colony.
These little bell-shaped buds are called medusa, and they have male and female parts.
Somehow those parts find each other in the big wide ocean, and they get together and make this little larvae floats up to the surface and grows into this colony.
For people, this would be like if your genitals fell off, went and found other genitals, had sex, and made a baby without you. That's how Velella velella reproduce. And in the meantime, what do they eat? Plankton and fish eggs. However,
they haven't developed an anus yet. Food goes in and comes out the same place. It's a cul-de-sac, not a one-way street.
Velella velella also have special algae living on them that feed off the waste from that cul-de-sac and turn sunlight into sugars that feed the velella. So even if there's no food around in that big open ocean, they can still survive for a while.
Imagine if we had this. We could go out in the sun, sunbathe, and we'd be able to get lunch.
The velella doesn't normally want to be close to the shore.
And the best thing for it is to be able to stay out in the ocean. It likes to live beyond the continental shelf.
Velella velella only end up on the beach when warm waters push them there.
This is my favorite thing about Velella velella, and that is that, we actually have to back up a little bit. So we have to talk a little bit about currents.
So in the northern hemisphere, currents go in a clockwise progression. This is called the Pacific Gyre. The Velella ride this using their sails to tack in the wind. If you look at them from above, most sails are angled like a backslash on the oval bodies. Mueller thinks this is so they can tack in a clockwise current forever, floating in big clockwise circles in the ocean. In the southern hemisphere, winds go in the opposite direction, counterclockwise. So he says Velella sails flip below the equator. The backslash becomes a forward slash. And Mueller says this is where the trouble can start. Sometimes these southern winds come up along the coast and disrupt the clockwise current.
Their sail's designed for the Pacific Gyre. So southern's opposite of that, the sail doesn't work. They go the other way and they go onto land.
Instead of circling back into the ocean, the velellas head for the beach. It doesn't happen all the time, but it's common, happening about every 3 to 7 years. Mueller says decades ago, his mentor, a marine biologist named Al Molina, noticed that Velella velella beachings followed a certain pattern.
He noticed over the many years, probably for him maybe 40, 45 years, that he was observing these, that when they came ashore, it was a sign of drought, and when they didn't, it was a sign of a wet year.
Nobody has done any scientific studies to confirm this. Mueller says it's a difficult population to research. You'd need floating research stations to follow Velella around over several years. So for now, we wait for the Velella velella to come to us. For Cross Currents, I'm Jessica Plotcheck.
That piece originally aired in July 2015. While the parking lots on San Francisco's west side are currently closed, Ocean Beach is open. If you walk, jog, or bike along the beach, you can see the Valela Valelas for yourself from a safe distance. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. We're coming towards the end of April, which is National Poetry Month. For some, poetry helps us make sense of what's going on in the world, especially during times like this. M.K. Chavez writes poetry that reflects on what's going on in society and deep inside herself. Her work has been honored by Penn Oakland, the Berkeley Public Library Foundation, among others. KALW's Janae Darden spoke to MK about her themes in her writing, including nature and her mother's battle with schizophrenia.
You are one of my favorite writers. If someone asks me when I do readings, if someone says, who are you reading? I'll list you with like Toni Morrison and Isabel Allende. What made MK pick up the pen? Who made MK pick up the pen?
Well, first I want to say that it thrills me to hear you say that you like my work. It's an honor. I was probably really meant to write much earlier than I started. But as you know, when you're growing up, you don't necessarily get validation for creative endeavors, right? So I remember writing stories when I was really little. They were really crazy stories. And, you know, it got kind of brushed off as a phase that I would move my way out of. So I didn't actually start writing too much later in my life. And I want to say that really it was multiple exposures to women writers. So Sandra Cisneros, Anne Carson. But it was also not just poetry, but it was also writings that were life transforming. I mean, that the poetry of both of those poets feels that way to me for very different reasons. One of the key moments for me figuring out the power of writing was reading Malcolm X's autobiography. And being a kid who went to private school and was pretty isolated, reading that book made me feel less alone. It gave me context for which to understand the world, because I wasn't getting context for my family, because my family was just trying to survive, trying to fit in, trying to assimilate. Reading Malcolm X's about his experiences, but also his synthesis of his life and how he was going to lead his life was so moving to me. And I think that stayed with me.
I mean, one of the things I love about your work is that you have such a beautiful command of prose. One of the books that you've written is Mother Morphosis. And you were talking about some of the struggles you went through as a kid. And I know that this chapbook is about living with your mother who has schizophrenia. Was that hard for you to write about something like that?
It was and it was not. Even though rationally, I understood that I was not alone and that mental health is all, you know, exists everywhere, including communities of color. But I had never talked about it. So the part that was really healing was the, you know, just the birth of this book and kind of being pushed through the process out into having it pushed into the light. And then suddenly I wasn't alone, like on a very real level. You know, I have found the conduit to where I could talk to about my mother's mental health and what it's like to grow up with someone who's struggling with mental health issues and the intersections of being a person of color and dealing with all of the other various things that you have to deal with when you're growing up as a child of color.
You have a love of nature and animals. That comes up a lot in your work. Where did you get that love for nature and animals from?
Strangely, I think had a lot to do with my mother, actually. We were not like a nature-going family, but I had a very significant event happen with my mom. My mother had been displaying symptoms for a long time, and my family was in deep denial. They just kind of, they just kind of accepted that she had strange behaviors, like believing that people were talking about her, strangers, things like that. They just absorbed it into the family structure. But eventually, my mother had a psychotic break that was very dramatic, and we happened to be camping. And so in the middle of the night, my mother decided that she was going to take me into the woods to lose me. And the act for her, I believe, was not an act of, you know, abandonment or trying to be cruel. I think that in her moment of extreme distress and paranoia, she felt, I mean, she said, "You'll be safer here." Like when she deposited me, she said, "You'll be safer here." And I believed my mom. I had no point of reference. Like, my mom didn't seem weird to me. She had been loving. She had been a good mother. She protected me. And I had no reason not to believe her. So this moment of being left in the woods and really feeling that feeling like I'm going to be safe, I think in some way really transferred over in some way. Because I've always gravitated towards nature, and it's kind of my place of solace. I married a tree last year.
How's that relationship going?
You know, it was pretty good. Trees are pretty amazing and understanding, and, you know, we have a unique relationship.
I noticed in Dear Animal and in your other work, when nature and animals come up, that you also too tap into womanhood, learning about your womanhood, the mysteries of womanhood, challenging what we've been told what womanhood is supposed to be. And I see all of that come up in your work and looking at animals and looking at nature and woman's nature.
I think that when I marry the tree, I also marry myself. I marry myself to this way of life, of seeing, of being with nature and the world. Dear Animal was also born out of my experience as a woman and me really seeing these ways in which women are treated as if there's some sort of disconnect. Like, we don't understand that emotional creature, you know, even the terminology, like, oh, you know, emotional, women are emotional creatures, as if we haven't expressed why it is that we might be screeching in a corner. There's usually a pretty good reason. So I saw that similarity. And I also saw that similarity in terms of responses, the magical ways in which women show their resilience. I think women are amazing.
That was poet M.K. Chavez speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. M.K. is the author of Mother Morphosis and Dear Animal. You can find more about her at KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Countless Bay Area authors with spring book release dates have had to cancel launch parties and book tours because of the coronavirus. So we are here to bring them to you in this series we're calling New Arrivals. Author C. Pam Jiang lives in San Francisco. Her novel is called How Much of These Hills is Gold? It came out April 7th. Here she is.
It's a new American epic, one that rewrites the mythology of the California Gold Rush, and starts one day when two children of immigrants wake up and discover that their father has died in the night. Here is the very beginning. Ba dies in the night, prompting them to seek two silver dollars. Sam's tapping an angry beat come morning, but Lucy, before they go, feels a need to speak. Silence weighs harder on her, pushes till she gives way. "Sorry," she says to Ba in his bed. The sheet that tucks him is the only clean stretch in this dim and dusty shack, every surface black with coal. Ba didn't heed the mess while living, and in death his mean squint goes right past it. Past Lucy. Straight to Sam. Sam, the favorite, round bundle of impatience circling the doorway in two big boots. Sam clung to Ba's every word while living, and now won't meet the man's gaze. That's when it hits Lucy. Ba really is gone.
That was Sipam Jang reading from her book, How Much of These Hills is Gold? For more information on that and other books by local authors released this spring, go to klw.org/newarrivals. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.